Hi, everyone. I'm Maya.
And I'm Jeff Childs.
And this is Transforming Together, the HopeWorks podcast. So over the last couple of weeks, we at HopeWorks have created a podcast series to talk about the current situation in this country around COVID-19. Today, we're going to be moving past the specific topics of COVID-19 to talk about the intersecting issues of racism and white supremacy and how that affects the way certain communities, namely Black, Brown, and incarcerated communities, are being affected by COVID-19. Today, we have a very special guest with us. Dr. Kenya Nuru Dennis is a community activist, criminologist, and sociologist, and founder of her own company, 365 Diversity LLC. As an educator, trainer, evaluator, and researcher, Dr. Dennis helps improve marketing, recruitment, training, policies, and procedures and behaviors in K-12 schools, colleges, universities, businesses, and organizations, including police departments, medical health facilities, and public school officials. 365 Diversity LLC advances inclusion, equity, and justice for underrepresented and marginalized communities, customers, consumers, and patients by reaching decision makers willing and able to make measurable and lasting changes. Learn more about Dr. Kenya Nuru Dennis and 365 Diversity LLC at www.365diversity.com. Dr. Kenya, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. We're really excited to have this conversation. So for this episode, we really wanted to talk about the historical context of systemic racism, how it connects to COVID-19 crisis, specifically focusing on Black and Brown communities and incarcerated communities, and what communities can do to actually fight against systems of violence, including conversations around mutual aid and community care.
Yes, important discussion.
And just as a kind of acknowledgement as well, that while this is going on, the Black Lives Matter movement has been gaining a lot of momentum and a lot of conversation in the past 2 weeks. It's a really important conversation because this will also intersect with COVID-19, whether people realize it or not. So we're hoping to kind of show, like Maya said, this historical context, how it's available in the present moment, and then moving forward, how do we care for each other?
And before we get started, I'd just like to say their names. Since the beginning of 2020, there have been numerous murders by police of Black folks and a lot of murders and killings of Black trans folks. So we're going to say a couple of those names. So Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Tony McDade, Nina Pop. So I think we wanted to kind of ground our conversation in the historical context of systemic racism. We know that this country was founded on the institution of slavery and white supremacy. We've seen that after the Civil War, slavery, white supremacy, and institutional oppression have been consistently reworked and repackaged into the United States structure to adapt to the new legal and social program paradigms, such as the invention of Jim Crow, the 13th Amendment, transformation of slave labor through prison labor, quote-unquote stop and frisk, and more. This continues to happen throughout America's history. Dr. Kenya, can you speak on these methods of transforming, repackaging racism and white supremacy perpetuated by the state, especially in the context of medical and labor-based racism?
Yes. So first we want to remember we are all on stolen land, right? So land stolen from Native, Indigenous. We're talking about hundreds of cultures, languages, spiritualities. It's important to remember the stolen land. So thankfully, there are organizations in North America, which includes Canada, that have created a map so that you can actually look up the area where you live and find the different cultures that lived in the area perhaps thousands of years before this land was stolen. And so when we talk about how this land was stolen originally, and then we talk about transatlantic slavery, it's very common for whites to respond by saying, well, humans have stolen stuff for thousands of years around the world. Slavery existed everywhere and all that stuff. And I tell whites, the fact that whites have this constant need to distract from the discussion is an illustration of how whites have been the creators and the perpetuators of white dominance, such that despite me being on this continent because of slavery, whites are allowed to try to shut me up. And most people, including most Blacks, allow whites to shut me up because they're like, well, maybe you shouldn't have said it that way. So it's important to understand why we are going to keep discussing this, and not just why we discuss it, but I also do work with policies and procedures. I challenge police departments, and this is every police department. I don't care how many Black folk they have smiling in front of me as police officers. It's all founded in Emancipation Proclamation, the killing and scaring of Blacks and also brown people as well. So we just want people to understand why this is going to keep being discussed. And if people don't want to hear it, they need to look internally and ask themselves, despite data that has been presented for more than a century by Black and brown people, why do people keep wanting this not to be discussed? But then they want to march with us in honor of George Floyd. I'll be honest, a lot of the whites who are marching with us for George Floyd now have been whites telling us to calm down for years. Because if all these whites were so proactive and conscious before George Floyd, a lot of changes would have already happened. So an example of how we have to hold whites accountable everywhere and at all times includes Mitt Romney. Now people are celebrating Mitt Romney for marching, which is bare minimum effort, like so bare minimum, right? And I say this because I challenge all whites. I don't care if you're white liberal, white Democrat, white conservative, white Republican, you supposedly anti-racist, I don't care, because instead of these whites coming to us constantly, instead of Mitt Romney marching with us, Mitt Romney needs to be challenging himself as a white man and challenging fellow whites. And when I say this, it's not only cisgender, heterosexual whites, it's all whites. And that's important to say because one thing that has bothered me with the George Floyd protests is Blacks are expected to ignore facts of white dominance, to ignore how most whites are silent spectators to our harm. And we're supposed to now be like, oh, yay, white people. It's more white people here than Black people. Yay. Actually, no. It's hard for us to get away from white people. White people are everywhere. So white people taking over our protests actually annoys me. And it's also not white accountability. It takes nothing to show up at a protest with a poster. Nothing. And this is also my challenge to white LGBTQ showing up at protests. Now I want you to go to these predominantly white LGBTQ organizations and make them not based on white power. There's a reason why Black and brown people have to create our own pride parades and so forth. So this is where accountability is important, including when whites are helping. We have to hold whites accountable and say, okay, your little bit of help, your little grain of help is not enough. I'm not going to celebrate you when our people have done this work for centuries and been murdered. We've been terminated from jobs, kicked out of schools, all this stuff. So white people showing up sometimes, to me, it's not something to celebrate. Like that article where they showed all the white women standing in front of the Black crowd between the cops and the crowd. And that was sent around without the context of it was a Black woman who told them to stand there, right? So it's this constant desperation to constantly celebrate white people. And now this book, and again, I'm a sociologist, so Dr. Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, is being marveled. Again, Dr. DiAngelo is a wonderful sociologist and scholar. She's pulling from what Black and brown people have written about for over a century. So I despise hearing people quote Dr. DiAngelo's White Fragility, or any other new book for that matter, but not thinking about, what did Dr. Anna Julia Cooper write, Black woman sociologist?
Can I step in real fast and just
definitely
what you said? So I just want to thank you so much for saying that. Something that's been weighing heavy on my mind is just the performance of all of this activism and how it's easy to stand up and protest in a time of crisis. But the reason none of these movements have made much of a difference and nothing, there hasn't been much change that has come from these decades and decades of Black women leaders leading these movements is because white folks and non-Black allies are coming in when it's convenient to them and leaving when it's convenient to them. And
yeah,
And if when we continue to celebrate people for doing the bare minimum, like standing up against racism, for demanding that police be held accountable for the murder of humans, of Black folks, like that is the bare minimum. That is the bare minimum. You don't get cookies. But when we see these instances where people are celebrating white folks, at the end of the day, the system's functioning the way that it's supposed to be functions. It's taking away from the Black femme and trans leaders who have been at the forefront of this movement. It's celebrating these white folks, and it's getting away from the core issue, which is addressing systemic racism that is intertwined and functions to support all systems of violence in this country. And I want to uplift your work as a Black sociologist professor, because I know that
former professor and
leader of your own organization who's doing this work every single day, that though you're doing this work, your voice isn't centered and it deserves to be centered. We still, in this movement, this nationwide movement to address racism and white supremacy, the voices who are being uplifted are these non-Black allies, specifically these white allies who have the credit. And then again, repeating what you said, stealing the words and the language and the research that Black women have created and them being propped up for sharing that information. And
yeah,
I wonder if you could address, kind of go back to the root of this question, mm-hmm. a little bit about how these methods of white supremacy have been transformed into our current systems via like the forced labor, the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. the prison industrial complex, and talk about that, because, you know, we can have these conversations and be upset about, you know, white folks who are the only ones being listened to, who are stealing our voices. But at the end of the day, we need to get back to the root of this and making people sit in the uncomfortability of America's past and its present and its current situation. So I'm wondering if you can address some of that.
Yeah, so the original question included thousands of years. So let's mm-hmm. narrow it down perhaps to the centuries part, because that's when whites created racial categories and white privilege and white dominance and white supremacy began. So when we talk about the creation of race, of course, sociologically, we address how race is not biological. Neither is ethnicity, neither is culture, neither is language. These are created. However, when we say creation, we explain this in Intro to Sociology when we teach it. A lot of times people hear creation and they're like, oh, that means it really doesn't exist. That's not true, you know. It really is existing in terms of life outcomes. Same thing when we talk about gender. We can talk about gender fluidity, but fact still remains. Even people who are gender non-identifying will admit to struggling to figure out what gender non-identity means in terms of how other people treat them. So that's the real lasting impact of all of these creations that we have as humans. And for centuries, we're talking about race. So a lot of times when we talk about whites creating racial categories, we're talking about how whites use these very narrow categories to combine all these different ethnic and cultural and religious groups based on facial features, based on body type, based on language. Of course, if you're looking at the continent of Africa, parts of Asia, we can look at how this notion of Negro was created, colored was created. And also, it's also based on this notion that whites are powerful, but also racially neutral and racially objective, which is why when we look at white history, I always say white history, because when we talk about history, a lot of people look at it from the standpoint of what were white folk doing back then? And that's around the world. And so a lot of people say, well, the answer to that must be get rid of white people, you know, get rid of whiteness. And I say, no, we can't get rid of white category, because that goes back to this notion that whites are a neutral authority on everything. Like they're aliens telling the rest of us what to do.
Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate you saying that, because, I think it's a really interesting conversation on how do we separate now, like this narrative that we don't really get a chance to talk about in the mainstream or in our educational institutions, and how do we separate that from fact and from propaganda and from, you know, how do we now gain the truth out of all these years and centuries of remodeling and reshaping the way race and people are treated? And in the moment that we're in now that we have all of this information, where do we, you know, get the ability to discern how this has impacted us? And I think you've spoken really beautifully about that. And I wanted to ask now a kind of connecting question, especially with COVID-19 and the protests and everything that you've talked about is, you know, a lot of the things that I've heard are surrounding the protests is that there's going to be most likely, for example, a surge in COVID cases due to the protests, but kind of that this is going to be also used to ignore the fact that a lot of state governors, the federal administration had been pushing for the reopening of the states weeks before, and that a lot of the blame is going to shift to the Black Lives Matter protests right now. And the reason I'm connecting that and connecting that with our historical context conversation is because, like we've mentioned time and time again, is this is not anything new. And this is the way that, you know, movements get repackaged and retold through the, you know, the oppressor's narrative so that they can continue the same normal that they've been perpetuating for centuries. So I guess my question here is connected with the comment about propaganda and truth, is for you, how do you feel yourself navigating that? How do you feel that people should be, you know, instructing themselves to discern what they believe, you know, propaganda and truth to be, the state's narrative versus the people's narrative? And then connecting that with COVID, how can we talk about the healthcare system and change the healthcare system in a positive way so that once we know the truth, we can create that real change?
And thank you for that. So that's part of the work that I do as well is health equity. And for years I've done trainings and teaching about community health. And this is one thing that I always have to explain is that most medical health students are not taught about demographic cultural variants in health conditions and health services, even in undergrad, medical school, and throughout their careers. So when people such as me show up talking about health equity and cultural variants, a lot of medical doctors are offended. And this includes Black and brown medical doctors, because we have to remember when medical schools and a lot of medical facilities hire Black and brown people, they intentionally hire people who they consider tokens to represent quote unquote diversity, but who are not going to change the very white landscape. And that's based on this falsehood that whites, and particularly white men, are the creators of sciences and medicines, despite thousands of years of holistic health around the world, right? So I want to highlight that because most Blacks have a good reason not to trust medical professionals. We have a very good reason. We have centuries of reason, right? Even before there was an institutional review board process for research, we were used as lab experiments. You can look at how we were treated by when we went to the medical hospitals, if we did go in the first place. So for centuries, so it's passed down from generation to generation, not only health conditions, but also this notion of pray it away. So that's for Black Christians, Black Muslims, Black Jews, and Blacks of various religiosities, that we can somehow meditate our health conditions away, or these health conditions were created by whites. And with the work that I do, I have to combat that as well, to explain to Blacks that these health conditions really do exist, and they can be a result of also certain life decisions as well. But I also say it with a disclaimer. I understand why we do not trust medical doctors, okay? And medical doctors, when we find some good medical doctors who are culturally conscious, it is extremely rare, no matter where you live. So you get a look at a place like Baltimore. Baltimore is a predominantly Black city, whereas most health professionals are white. These well-celebrated medical facilities are dominated by whites, controlled by whites, some of whom are surrounded by wealthy whites living in surrounding areas, okay? So therefore, during COVID, now these medical professionals want Blacks to defer to their opinion, which changes every week because that's the ongoing process of scientific research, okay? Initially, they were like, you don't have to wear a mask. Now they say you have to wear a mask. So instead of preaching to Black people and doing what whites have done for centuries, which is say, oh, you shouldn't have been protesting, it's your fault that you got sick, that's what's happening now, no matter the language they use. Instead of doing that very white routine they need to do what some protesters are doing, bringing masks and saying, hey, if you don't have a mask, I have a mask for you. At the Baltimore protests that I've attended, most people stay 6 feet away. Some people do not. That's a personal choice as well. Of course, the safest thing is to stay at home in the first place. So if people are going to protest, I do recommend wearing a mask, standing 6 feet away from people whom you don't know. That's also something for protest coordinators to remember, is we're reaching a culture. I mean, this is still about Blacks. No matter how many white folks show up, this is still about Blacks. We're reaching a culture of people who tend not to trust medical advice for various reasons. So the protest planners should do some announcements and reminders like, hey, COVID is still out here. We know how some of our people feel about that, but just in case, let's be careful, okay? So I say in that sense, the planners of our protests can take responsibility. If you have a mask, make sure you don't take it off too much and follow the procedures there. But again, the responsibility is also on these medical spokespersons who are mostly white, who they want to make money by opening back up the economy, but then they want to keep pointing at Black protesters and saying you're spreading COVID. White protesters as well, but you know, this is a Black-led movement here. And someone's going to try to connect the two and say, well, the economy's failing now because we reopened, but those darn Black protesters have brought COVID into our businesses now. It's all going, they're going to find a way to connect that as well. This is that, like I always say, this is the same recipe of white dominance. And I don't just say systemic racism, because when we say systemic institutional, white people try to use that as an excuse to act like they have no idea how this is happening. And this is why I point at white people and I say, well, white people, this is about you. You are the ones who are in power of the system, of the institutions, even if Black people are the spokespersons. So if white people want COVID to stop spreading during these protests, they need to get quicker at understanding the purpose of the protests, remind people about masks, of course, but understand the purpose and say, how can we take responsibility for the reason this protest is happening in the first place? And what do we need to do to make measurable, lasting changes in every institution so that Blacks will not have to protest so much, especially during COVID?
Yeah, Dr. Kimia, thank you so much for that. I just want to say my experience going to protests. On this past week, I went to a Black Trans Lives Matter protest, and which was so deeply powerful and led by beautiful Black and brown trans women and men. And it was so beautiful because of so many of the reasons, but we saw so much community support. And, you know, I saw people who I'm assuming are EMTs in their personal lives and other medical professionals coming out there, handing out water bottles, handing out masks, making sure throughout the entire 4-hour protest that people had access to hand sanitizers, to masks, to food, and like white allies using their privilege, their access to goods, their access to being the people who will be most listened to support Black trans women and this movement. So before we go, I'd just like to ask if you had a couple of points you'd like to make about the movement towards mutual aid and community care that we've been seeing, especially since the start of COVID. And then we'll share a little bit, before we go, we'll share a little bit about some upcoming events at HopeWorks.
Okay, so just really quickly, so Wesley Hawkins in Baltimore is one of the leaders of the protests here in Baltimore, and last week he did something wonderful that had me fighting back tears. He actually gave an announcement at the beginning of the protest that when we're talking about equity for Blacks, we're including all Blacks across sexualities, gender identities, Black, LGBTQ, and I was very proud because Black Lives Matter, despite being founded by 4 queer Black women, has been presented by Black communities around the world even as being about only cisgender heterosexual Black men. So I was so excited that he did that. And so for the protests, there's been a representation of Black LGBTQ in a safe space. Also, when we're talking about COVID, again, reminder for people to have masks if possible, 6 feet. But also I want these white medical announcers to remember that when white people were going without masks and with firearms, spitting in the face of police officers because white people did not want to be quarantined, white people did not want to, when white people were doing that, these white medical professionals were not screaming about COVID as much. They were not fussing at these white protesters about spreading COVID to police officers and other things. Instead, everyone was celebrating the freedom to protest, because we have to remember, freedom of speech and right to bear arms was created by white people for white people. So nobody was preaching to these white people about their white firearm outrage over simply not being able to go get a haircut. So I want them to understand that people such as myself see through this. We understand it's not just about COVID. It's also about finding different ways to silence Black voices and try to make us feel guilty, as was done for 401 years, even on slave plantations, when the cabbage didn't come out right. Blacks were made to feel guilty. And so that's the same routine happening now. And I want our people to stay safe from COVID while also understanding nonsense when we hear it.
And I really appreciate you saying that, because I think it's like a beautiful way of talking about the way that all Black Lives Matter protests and all the marches and rallies have been really keeping in mind COVID practices and social distancing measures, and really keeping that community care at the forefront of a lot of these rallies. It's really telling that even the most oppressed peoples in our communities are still making sure and taking the time to take care of other people and help them find ways to still contribute and, you know, help and support the movement. So thank you for mentioning that.
Thank you.
And I would just like to thank you, Dr. Kimya Nuru-Dennis, for joining us for this podcast. You'll be here for our next episode, and we're really excited to have you on for that. But thank you so much for this powerful conversation and being so unapologetic in naming these systems that have created and perpetuated white supremacy and racism and anti-Blackness and violence all throughout this country and the world. Before we go, I'd like to give some announcements about HopeWorks. HopeWorks is still open. We are currently working through teletherapy, and our office doors are closed, but the main staff is still open. You can reach us at 410-997-0304. That is our main office number. If you or anyone you know is in a domestic violence, intimate partner violence, or human trafficking situation, please know that our hotline and our office is here to support you. And before we go, we have a couple of upcoming events that we want to share. On June 27th, HopeWorks will be starting our Quilt Bag community group. Quilt Bag is a group created for and by queer and trans artists, crafters, and creatives of all kinds. This space is where LGBTQ plus folks can connect through art, no experience created. On June 27th from 12 to 2 p.m. over Zoom, we will be gathering for our first meeting to get to know each other, engage in conversation about LGBTQ rights and what's happening in this world, and collectively share and create work. You can find more about our events at wearehopeworks.org/events. Additionally, me, Maya Carey, I have started the Between the Lines, a Liberation Book Club, which is a book club that meets on the first and third Monday of the month from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. with the goal of celebrating the work of Black, queer, and trans, and brown educators and activists. For this month's meeting, for the end of this month on June 15th, we will be meeting to finish up our book discussion around Charlene Carruthers' book, Unapologetic, a Black Queer Feminist Mandate for Radical Movement Makers. And then finally, we have two other events, the Dragonfly Poetry Reading, which is our annual poetry reading celebrating the artists and work that went into our annual arts and culture magazine, will be on June 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. over Zoom. And then Jeff Choate, do you want to come in and talk about Cultivate Poetry Reading?
Yes, so Cultivate is our youth arts magazine that was created and facilitated through our youth leadership project. We're very, very, very proud of the magazine that they've created, and in order to support and celebrate the youth artists and poets that submitted to the magazine and really cultivate that artistic license and movement, we are going to be having a Cultivate Poetry Reading in July. You'll be able to find more details around that at wearehopeworks.org/events.
So thank you. I want to thank you again, Dr. Kimya Nuru-Dennis, for joining us, and Jeff Joth. Until next time, this is Transforming Together, and I'm Maya.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.